Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by cradiodifferently.com. I'm Timothy James Burrows.
And I'm Robin James Anthony Hicks.
My name is John Kenneth Hartigan. Occupation, journalist. A journalist is what I am, who I am, and what I'll always be. When you wanted to be a journalist as fervently as I did, took as long to become one as I did, and love it as much as I do, you are never anything else.
This week, News Limited boss John Hartigan retires.
Google Plus opens to brands.
Fat fighting.
Ageism in the ad industry.
Controversial Kiwi Paul Henry joins Tan.
Also the dipshit woman. God, what's her name? Dick shit.
Celebrity apprentice powers on.
Our guest today at Mumbrella House is Richard Curtis, Managing Director of branding agency Interband.
Hello, folks.
And also with us, podcast producer Colin Delaney.
Hello.
Now, Richard, welcome along. Maybe let's start. What's new at Interband at the moment?
Well, I mean, a lot's been new this year. It's been a really massive year for us in terms of growth. New clients, new people.
How many people are you up to now?
We're about 50 now.
In Sydney or
in
across
Sydney.
Australia?
Yep, just in Sydney. About 20 or so of those have been new this year. So there's been a lot of early mornings and late nights interviewing people. Just really proud with the growth of the agency. We, you know, set ourselves up for success in terms of what we wanted to do and the type of agency we wanted to be, because there was a lot of change that needed to happen with Interbrand. Having turned around the agency over the past 3 years, very much looking ahead to the future in terms of how far we can take it.
Now, one of the big campaigns everyone was talking about was the rebrand of Telstra.
Yeah, look, I think that really put us on the map in some respects, in terms of the type of work that we want to do. I think too long there's been a lot of agencies generally who have one half of the business that have the big churn and burn clients driving all the revenue, the other half works on the artsy boutique stuff that wins awards but doesn't necessarily contribute financially. And we've always been very front and centre about doing work that is not only creatively outstanding but also, you know, commercially great as well.
Is it Telstra that's driven that growth of Interbrand? We say primarily that one client. You've got other clients, obviously McDonald's House Charities being one, Griffin Theatre. But they're smaller clients, I would imagine, compared to the Goliath that is Telstra. Is Telstra the reason for growth?
Oh, look, there's no doubt that Telstra has contributed largely to that. But, you know, they're just one of a number of our clients. We don't have the sort of... kind of list of clients whereby we're, you know, actively promoting the pitches in which we're working and the type of business we're picking up, because it just doesn't work that way in terms of the way in which we're engaged and the type of problems we're solving. So, you know, we're not typically in a position to talk about the people with whom we're working. But, you know, it's important for an agency like us to have a diverse mix in terms of, you know, the size and scale and type of work that we're doing. So it's everything from crumpets to pink diamonds.
Yeah. I mean, the nature of branding, correct me if I'm wrong, is it's a lot of project work. So an outside observer would say, hang on, you've piled on 20 new people at least this year. Is that sustainable when the, you know, the nature of the business is project work?
And look, it's a perennial challenge for any business like ours where you are working on projects, and the vast majority of our clients are project-based rather than retained on fees. And so we are on this continual 12-week cycle of working on projects whilst finding new business. So you have to not take your after ball in terms of looking for new opportunities and converting those opportunities to bring the new work in. I'm really, you know, excited and proud of the fact that our pitch win rate for the last 12 months is 98%. So typically when we get in front of a client, we're able to win that opportunity.
And do you usually pitch on case studies, or do you actually deliver some work to the client?
Typically, we don't pitch creatively in terms of, I suppose, in simple terms, giving away free work. But we'll always have a point of view. So yes, we'll bolster that with credentials and case studies, but we'll always talk to clients and prospects about our point of view on their business or on their category or industry, and the way in which brand ought to play out and where it can start to contribute to their business and drive some sort of a commercial outcome or a greater degree of employee engagement, or how language might work and play a role, a greater role in their business.
Yeah. Now, last week, Rob Belgiofani, who's the ECD at BWM, with whom Telstra used to work, he said that the Telstra rebranding felt a bit Apple in feel.
And he meant in a good way.
Yeah, in a good way. Was that at all an influence when creating that new brand architecture?
Yeah, do you talk about the brands you want to be a bit like, you know, when you're positioning something?
No. I mean, the heart and soul of what we do is what's true to that organisation, true to that brand, or true to that business. And a lot of what we're doing is not necessarily creating anything new. It's just unlocking what's already there. There's going to be a certain spirit or an ethos or a character to any organisation or business and brand, and it's about how you bring that to the surface and maybe communicate that in a more effective or more powerful way. So the starting point is always, well, what's at the heart of this opportunity, this business, this brand, whatever it might be, rather than can we make them a little bit like this or a little bit like that, because it just won't wash. And a lot of what we do is not communications related at all. It's about how you work with a brand in terms of building an experience for customers and also that experience for employees. So it's about how employees deliver that brand experience, how you might build a pipeline of new products that deliver that brand promise. And so communications is really just one part of the mix in the way that we talk about the role of brand in an organisation.
And when there is a rebrand, often there's an ad agency involved as well. Sometimes it's DDB, which is a sister agency to you. So I guess you draw the picture and then they colour in between the lines. Is that how it works?
Look, there's inevitably different relationships with different agencies. Obviously, we have a very close relationship with DDB and the other agencies within the DDB group. And I love getting the chance to work with those guys and girls. I think they do some great work. But similarly, we work with lots of other agencies as well. And typically, it can be a little bit chicken and egg, but, typically we're working on, well, what's the brand idea? What's the strategy? How do you start to express that? And we might then go off and bring that to life through employee engagement programs or a verbal identity or through, the look and feel of the brand itself, so collateral or digital or whatever it might be. But, there's always going to be other agencies who are executing in terms of their specific areas of specialism.
Yeah. But is there ever a sense of frustration that you're Interbrand, you're an agency, and in the UK where I'm from, Interbrand is Interbrand. It just so happens to be part of Omnicom, but it certainly isn't part of DDB Group. Here in Australia, you guys fall within the DDB Group umbrella. Isn't it frustrating that, you want to be your own people, your own brand, perhaps your own building? Is there ever a sense of, we want to be ourselves rather than part of something else?
Yeah, you're the little brother.
You've got it. Nah. It's not like that at all. I think we certainly have a very kind of unique culture, a very different culture. We live in the same brick building, but we've been very focused on being Interbrand. And I think we've done well insofar as setting out our stall as Interbrand. Inevitably there's benefits, the chance to work with people like Chris Brown and Marty O'Halloran, Dylan Harrison, those guys, relish the opportunity to be in meetings, work on projects with those guys. But at the same time, we get the benefits of being part of that group, but we also give you the benefits of being independent of spirit, and we certainly get to create our own destiny in terms of who we work with and what we do. Yeah. So I'm pleased to say we get the best of both worlds.
And what is your character? When you helped rebrand Mango, the PR agency, I seem to remember the phrase being used was DDB's hot little sister, which they later accused me of misquoting them on, I'm sure, but I stand by it. But anyway, if Mango is DDB's hot little sister, what is Interbrand?
We're pretty forthright about setting our own standards, so I don't think we'd ever go down a path of comparing ourselves in that sort of a relative fashion. But we're very focused on doing work that stands apart. So we've got a very clear manifesto at the heart of our business, which is about ideas that stand apart, people that stand apart, and working with clients who want to stand apart. And we've got a manifesto that's, you know, big on the wall and is you know, on everyone's job descriptions. And we talk to people about, you know, through the year in terms of the culture and the type of work that we want to do, and obviously talking to people who are looking to join the agency about what that might be like. And the line that sums it up best for me is, when you stand apart, people will stand with you. And so we do want to be doing stuff that's different. We do want to be sticking our chins out, for better or for worse, but, you know, we'll back ourselves. And so we're looking to do things in a way that does stand apart. So we're not just thinking about packaging, for example, as the box. We're thinking about the retail experience, the shopper journey. You know, we're not just thinking about the visual look and feel of brands. We're thinking about language and how the verbal identity plays out. So in everything that we do, we're looking to stand apart. And certainly that's the promise that we make to our clients. And they inevitably have a valuable role in helping bring that to life as well. So there are going to be certain clients who do want to stand apart. And we absolutely relish the opportunity to work with them.
But now, Interbrands do a few surveys. One of them is the Global Brand Survey, which the last time that came out listed Coca-Cola as the most valuable brand, then IBM, then Microsoft, then Google, then GE, then McDonald's, then Intel, then Apple, then Disney, then HP. How do you actually value what a brand is worth?
With a lot of insight and expertise and, a lot of time and effort, really. We've been valuing brands for many, many years. We've valued over 5,000 brands around the world, so we've got a pretty good idea of how to do it. And we're the first, and I think we're the only agency that's ISO certified in terms of the brand valuation work that we do. And, you know, we're very proud of that track record and that history.
So if I say to you, right, the Mumbrella brand, what's it worth? How would you work it out?
Well, we'd get the back of an envelope. look, it's
that would do for us.
It starts with the financials. Everything is anchored in the financial value of the organisation. And then it's about an understanding of what role does brand play in delivering that financial output. So if you think of the different dynamics that make up any sort of purchase decision, so if you're buying a pair of shoes, it'll be the service in the store, it'll be the shoe, it'll be the brand, it'll be the price, all those sorts of things. Understanding what role brand plays in driving that decision. So brand might contribute to 25% of that decision. So that's the second part. And then the third part is brand strength. So there's 10 key brand strengths. Some are internal factors, some are external factors. And it's really about understanding the strength of the brand in contributing to that decision, and therefore effectively the risk factor in terms of the stronger your brand, the lower the risk of your brand value being eroded over time. So those three things in combination spit out a number. But I think the important thing is that the number itself is just the start, insofar as it's then how you manage that and how you work with those different levers to understand how you can increase your brand's value. And I think that's where it starts to get much more interesting than simply a league table of who's who in the zoo and how much they're worth.
Next, John Hardigan moves on from News Limited.
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Micro Citizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
This week saw John Hartigan, CEO of News Limited, step down. Hartigan will be replaced as CEO by Kim Williams, who currently runs Foxtel. Richard Freudenstein, currently boss of News Digital Media, and the Australian, will move across to Foxtel to replace Williams. Freudenstein helped launch Foxtel and also had a senior role at BSkyB in the UK. So, Tim, you were close to this one. We broke the news yesterday. You also wrote an opinion piece on it. What are your thoughts? Immediate gut reaction?
I mean, loads. Firstly, there's just the significance of John Hardigan, such a big character. Yeah. Within News Limited world and within journalism in Australia, moving on. So, you know, he headed up the Right to Know Coalition. He's you know, I was looking, you know, I was born in 1970. He was already a journalist for News at that point, on the, you know, on the route to being an editor. You know, this is a guy with so much experience. Loads of ups and downs with, you know, leading news. So we saw the Melbourne Storm stuff in the last few months, a pretty sour relationship with the government at the moment. But I don't think that's what it's about. I just think it's that Rupert has decided it's time. And I think, you know, you serve at Rupert's pleasure. So it does feel to me that in the end, Rupert has made the decision. If Rupert wanted him to stay, I'm sure he would have done so, because you don't get that high unless you're really loyal, and if Rupert asks you to stay, you stay. Lots of journalists love the fact that they're being led by a journalist. Mm. So the fact that they're not anymore will change the character. Not necessarily a bad thing for News Limited, because Kim Williams, what he brings over from Foxtel, is absolute expertise in getting people to pay for content. It so happens that it's pay TV rather than online news content that Kim Williams has done before, but there are plenty of talents he can bring across and plenty of skills and tricks he can move across. You know, this idea of, you know, for instance, when you at the moment, if you sign up for the Australian, when you know the free trial period is ended, you're just signing up for the Australian. Whereas over at Foxtel, you're signing up for a whole suite of different channels, a package. So it'll be really interesting if he brings that thinking across. And the other thing is, don't forget, he's had this really long career in the screen industry as well. So, you know, with sort of the financing of films, as well as the, you know, Foxtel's own investments, you know, he's been there, ex-ABC as well. So if you think about journalists creating content that's not just writing stories, then that's going to be really interesting, having him there looking at this, you know, sort of storytelling across different platforms. So that's really interesting. Absolutely. Frudenstein moving over to Foxtel makes total sense. He was at Foxtel before over here. He helped launch it. Then over in the UK, he ran BSkyB. As chief operating officer, so he's seen that market there. Then came back to Australia, was at News Digital, but you know, I think, you know, to a certain extent, he's always been a spare Kim Williams for, you know, when the moment was needed, which is now. So I don't think he's going to be sweating on his first day. What that means for the leadership of the Australian, probably we'll see John Allen step up on the commercial side, and News Digital Media, I don't think we'll have someone necessarily quite in the role that Frudy was. You know, we might see News Digital Media move more closely in with the rest of News. You know, as the brands have come together, it doesn't make sense to have one person running the print mastheads and another one running the digital ones. So obviously you've got some digital only products in the portfolio that would need managing in a different way, but I'd be surprised if he's directly replaced.
Yeah, I mean, you've been a journalist for the best part of 20 years. I'm sure you've had many different bosses. What would it mean to you as a journalist to have your boss, who was a journalist, replaced by someone who isn't?
Well, this is the great irony as well. You know, that was always a point of difference for News Limited, that they were led by a journalist, while Fairfax, the great enemy, was led by the bean counters, I have been for many years. So a year, you know, until a year ago, you had News Limited being led by the Walkley winning John Hardigan. As of December, we'll have News Limited led by somebody who's not a non-journalist. Fairfax now, of course, being led by the Walkley winning Greg Highwood. It's absolutely in the space of just one day short of a year, because it will be exactly a year from when Greg Highwood started that John Hardigan finishes. It's switched. Fairfax is now the organisation that's led by a journo.
Yes. Rich, from a branding perspective, you say how significant this is, that News no longer has a journalist at the helm, has a businessman at the helm. How do you think that will affect News as a brand?
I don't know if it'll affect it all that much, to be perfectly honest, in terms of the background of the individual leading the organisation. I mean, John Hardigan is a guy who I have huge admiration for. But at the same time, I think, you know, Kim Williams has done a great job over at Foxtel. But I think News Limited is bigger than them both.
Have you ever had much to do with John Hardigan?
I've had a few meetings with him. I was fortunate enough, because I really did enjoy the experience, fortunate enough to work on some projects with News Limited a few years ago. And he has an incredible presence, and that was obvious whenever he walked in the room. So I should acknowledge my bias, I suppose, in that I'm a big fan of News Limited as a business. But in terms of the journalist credentials, I think that will always be there. I think the News Limited brand is bigger than any one individual. But also, if you look at News Limited as an organisation, it does have a part of its DNA is to have relatively autonomous businesses within it, and very strong leadership of each of those businesses. So there might be some changes there, who knows? But I think they'll still be enough of the flavour of News Limited to carry them forward. But at the same time, they are a business going through a huge amount of change. But I think what's commendable is they're inflicting a lot of that change on themselves, as opposed to waiting. And if you wait, typically it becomes too late. So they seem to have almost taken the McDonald's approach in terms of inflicting it upon themselves and leading the charge. And I think that that can only be commended, and I think the change of leadership should act as a catalyst for that.
And of course, it's worth noting that whereas Hardigan was both CEO and chairman, Kim Williams will be CEO and Rupert Murdoch will be chairman, so it's nice to give that up-and-coming young businessman a chance as well.
Yeah. And anything significant about the timing of this? Sort of why now? Obviously, news has been in the news a lot, the Australians' paywall being erected not long ago at all. Now this, and any thoughts on the timing?
It's not coincidence, I'm sure, that Rupert was in the country in the last few days. You know, these big moves tend to happen when Rupert's over here. Typically, he visits about once a year. Usually, part of the News Limited do a big staff awards, so he's usually in the country for that. So I suspect that might be part of the timings. I don't think particularly it'll be external factors. You know, there's, you know, Hardigan will still be giving evidence to the media inquiry in the next few days, for instance. I don't think it's anything to do with that. But, you know, I guess the decision was made, and at some point you just have to, you know, push through with that decision.
Next, Google Plus opens to brands.
Google Plus has launched Pages, which allow brands to appear on the network for the first time. Let's listen to the proprietor of Zen Bikes in Michigan, what they have to say about Google Plus.
I make buddies of all my customers. It's really kind of a funny thing, and I think I've always had this this ability to kind of break down those walls and make people feel at home with how I work. I love my customers. I mean, I think as kooky as they can be, as kind of gruff as they can be, whatever, you know, send them all my way, and I can kind of I can cope with them and disarm them and make them feel at ease. I don't expect tips. I don't expect anything, you know, monetarily. That will come. But I just like their loyalty. I like that they come in and they know me, and they smile when they come into the shop and feel comfortable. What makes my job easy is I like dealing with people, so I do my best to please them, and that's what drives me.
So it ends with the tagline, businesses don't make people happy, people do. Richard, any thoughts on the pros and cons of Google Plus and what it can potentially do for brands over, say, Facebook or Twitter or anything else in the social networking sphere?
I think the interesting thing here is the increased level of engagement, that you can interact and participate and get involved. I think people have very quickly realised that getting likes on Facebook is kind of a bit shallow, it has a role to play inevitably, but it's a very superficial statistic, I think, how many people like you. And certainly, you know, if you talk to people with lots of Facebook friends, I mean, there's that whole thing about collecting friends, and then everyone started to wanting to unfriend all their friends. So I think Google Plus certainly gives much greater opportunity to get involved and to participate. And so, you know, like with most things Google do, they seem to be heading down the right track. I think it plugs into the rest of their business pretty well as well.
It does. That's one thing that, because it's been slow firing up, I guess, you know, getting people to spend as much time as they're spending on Facebook and effectively do it all over again with a different network of people is always a battle. It was interesting on the day they launched it, one of the early pages was for the Muppets. And one of the things you can do is you can do a hangout, you know, where people can kind of come on and look at the video and stuff. And I noticed the numbers were relatively small at this stage, so it's a slow burn.
Well, yeah, I mean, it could be perceived as a risk by some brands and businesses. I mean, look at Buzz, which is Google's answer to Twitter. That flopped horribly, didn't it? I just wonder what... Rich, perhaps in your context as a business, as Interbrand, would you think about using Google Plus? Obviously, one of its advantages, perhaps over Facebook, is that you can clearly segment the people you engage with. So you can have a different group for staff, different group for clients, different group for etc. How do you think you'd use it if you would use it?
I think it would be valuable. I mean, I don't quite know how, and this is the question with a lot of technologies. You see something and go, wow, I'd love to use that. I think this would be really valuable. And then you start to think about it and go, but I'm not quite sure how. But I don't think this is Emperor's New Clothes. I think this will evolve as a platform. And the fact that Google keep plugging away at this and having cracks and some work better than others, I think is to be commended. But I would love for us to, be able to find a way to use it.
Is it a matter? I remember we had a press release in yesterday. BCM, Brisbane agency, has gone on Google Plus, one of the first agencies, I think, in Australia. And their strategy is very much do, then learn, dive in and see what happens and see if it's of benefit. I remember BBH many years ago going to Second Life. Obviously, that didn't work out for them, but they're very much up for being pioneers, or at least being seen to do something first. Any plans for Interbrand?
Well, look, there's always a balance in any business like ours insofar as how much time you spend on yourselves versus how much time you spend on clients. And the client...
So get the clients to go on and learn at their expense.
Well, quite possibly. Although, you'd want to make sure you weren't making too many expensive mistakes along the way. But, I've worked at Macca's. It was two of the best days I've had this year. Loved working behind the counter. And nothing I do in this career will ever come close to... the look on my kids' faces serving them Happy Meals.
Did they trust you with a chip fryer? Or?
Yeah, I did the works. I working on fries, working on drive-through counter, making burgers.
Because if you work for an agency that works at McDonald's, everybody who works on it has to go and work in McDonald's for a day or two, don't they?
I'm not sure if it's have to in terms of, legally...
Strongly encouraged.
But it was something that we asked to do. We're about to work with, we've just kind of picked up a new client. And one of the things that we're going to be doing is spending a lot of time in call centers, a lot of time doing drive-ons and going on kind of service appointments. And I think the more you can get inside a business, the more you can really understand about what goes on. I think the days of taking a remote point of view around this stuff are long gone. So I think absolutely getting your hands dirty on this sort of stuff, Google Pages, whatever it might be, is valuable.
Next, obesity ad wars.
According to an article in the Sunday Telegraph and just last week, a health expert claimed that the Swap It, Don't Stop It anti-obesity campaign was a waste of money and should be scrapped. That actually turned out to be a misquote. I subsequently spoke to her and she said that, in fact, in isolation, a marketing campaign might not be effective without a holistic approach that includes education and community support. But I guess that the question is about effectiveness. Rich, can any medical expert say the campaign doesn't work, 7 months into it? Is it too early to be writing it off?
Look, it depends on the metrics. And if you look at the comments thread on that, the first few comments are, well, I got off the couch and did this, or I started running and did that. Now, if their view of success is, well, we got three people off the couch... then great, but you've succeeded. But if it's something bigger than that, then obviously they would seem to be a little way off. But I mean, I haven't seen the stats specifically, but obviously comms is only ever one part of the mix. But it really depends on what it is that you're setting yourself up to do and then charging towards that as an outcome.
Yeah, I also spoke to the client, the government client, who said that, look, this is a 10-year campaign to shrink people's waistlines. Only then can the effectiveness be measured. Tim, what do you make of the Bloom people in the campaign that incidentally was by JWT Melbourne?
Well, it's funny, when you watch or listen back-to-back to this current campaign and the Norm Life Be In It campaign from all those years before, there are some similarities. I mean, Norm was... I guess, 2 decades ago now, but that really influenced people in the same way. You know, it was very much a strategy of, you can incorporate this in your everyday life. You haven't got to change your life. And very, very persuasive it was too. Feels to me like this is a very similar strategy, and that's why I think it's working. Yeah, I like the campaign. I think it's a good campaign.
Yeah, I mean, the strategy, it appears to take a positive approach to cutting down the stuff you eat and becoming more active, rather than a negative approach. I've seen some ads in the past, government campaigns about, you know, people almost staggering, falling over, you know, from a heart attack. Rich, what do you think that is the right approach to take for this sort of campaign?
I think typically there are two options. You know, one is the fear sell, in which you scare the bejesus out of people and hope they change. I think the other is what seems to be happening with this campaign, which is change can be a very scary thing for people unless you are able to show the momentum that's already happening, to show them how they're already, by making small steps, on the path, and how maybe some things they've already been doing fit with this view of how they ought to continue to change for the future. So the the baby steps piece can work just as well as the big fear sell. And I don't think one is necessarily right or wrong. It really depends on the strategy and what's going to be the most effective way to achieve the outcome.
Next, ageism in advertising.
Thinking of working at an ad agency? Looking for the best creatives to develop your next ad campaign? Look no further than the Mumbrella Creative Agency Review. 148 pages of hardcore industry intelligence to help you make your next big agency decision. Visit book.focalattractions.com.au/MCAR.
This week, out of work adman Tony Sims. If you were at Mumbrella 360, you might have seen him talk about the issue at Mumbrella 360 back in June. He appeared on a sandwich board outside the windows of Seven Sunrise in Martin Place. Got a lot of publicity, got himself on telly, and also triggered a big debate on the Mumbrella comment thread. Now, Sims was formerly an executive with Chiel, Samsung's in-house ad agency. Now, Tony afterwards then came in and chatted to us here in Mumbrella House. And felt that he'd made some progress by doing this. He got some calls, he got some meetings. Richard, which is more important, wisdom or being young and cool, do you think?
I don't think wisdom is exclusively the rights of older people. And there is a thing in our society whereby, younger people are the cool, funky ones, but in other societies and cultures, well, it is the elders.
So as MD of Interbrand, do you struggle with the fact that you look about 12?
12's not bad. Maybe it's just because I had a shave. But I'm not the oldest looking lad in the world. If you look at our agency, I did the calcs this morning. It wasn't a difficult calculation. I think there's only one person over 40. So 2% isn't the greatest stat. But it isn't something that factors particularly, it doesn't really factor at all on our criteria. It's just a question of, well, who's got the smarts, who is going to impress us and focusing on the work.
And is it that somebody who, is 45, 50 will expect a sort of salary to reflect that, that agencies just can't afford anymore?
Oh, there's definitely that. I mean, I think about it as an MD and, all the people we've hired over the past year, but also the past, 3 or 4 years. If we were carrying, a big salary, then the expectations are much higher. So I'm not sure if we could jump straight on both feet in terms of supporting that just with the business model that we have. But I mean, just at a very personal level, I really only got serious about my career when I was about 28, 29. And I always have had a view, and I still have a view that, unless you've made it by 40, then you're not going to get a chance. So as much as I absolutely feel for this guy insofar as, he's out of work, I'm under no illusion that I might end up in exactly the same boat. Maybe I'm just taking a selfish view.
But isn't it also a cultural thing? If you're a young agency, that dynamic presumably would change if you started hiring lots of over 40s. Your culture would inevitably change.
It would obviously have an impact, but... the one person in our agency who's over 40, which is Damien Borchuk, our chief exec, who's based in Sydney, he has some of the, the most youthful, craziest, you know, whippersnapper ideas of any of us. And if anything, he's the one driving the boat. He's not just there as a figurehead. You know, likewise, you know, talking to Marty and some of those guys, I don't think age necessarily defines what then comes out of your brain. And that's why I really struggled with this insofar as what's the real story here. I don't know if anyone's reviewed his resume and so on and so forth to actually find out if the guy's any good or not.
Was he out of work at 360, by the way? Because that's a long time to be unemployed if you got decent amount of experience.
Yeah, he was talking about, certainly I think there'd been some consultancy and that sort of thing, but yeah, the issue was just not being taken seriously when he applied for big agency jobs.
But in terms of understanding how to integrate new media and old media, I mean, the sandwich board and the LinkedIn thing works phenomenally.
Absolutely. It was a great case study, wasn't it? Next, Paul Henry joins 10 for breakfast.
There's more to radio than music for your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
This week, 10 announced Kiwi Paul Henry would be one of the hosts of their new breakfast show, simply called Breakfast. Let's take a listen to one of the more infamous moments.
Anyway, so there's that yarn. Also, the dipshit woman. God, what's her name? Dick shit. Is it dick shit?
Dixit.
Oh, Dixit.
Dixit.
It just looks different to what you say.
Well, it looks like dick shit.
I know it does, Paul, but it's not that. It's Dixit.
There she is, there. Sheila Dixit. Sheila. Anyway, and it's so appropriate because she's Indian. So she'd be dickin' shit, wouldn't she? Do you know what I mean?
Paul, her name...
Walking along the street...
...is Ms. Dixit.
Oh, Dixit. Well, that's what I said, isn't it?
No.
No, you did not.
It's so funny.
Else.
Can we just have another look at the key? It's just so funny, isn't she? So how... We asked Mrs. Dixit what the condition of the apartments was like... Well, they're a bit mucky. Anyway, so that's a bit funny, isn't it? Delhi Chief Minister Sheila Dixit. Anyway, I know because I've known about her for a while, and I've been laughing ever since.
David Mott, 10's programming director, said, Paul is exactly what we've been after for breakfast. He's cheeky, mischievous, and unapologetically forthright, just like 10's viewers. Well, you can't ever be sure what Paul will do when he's on air. You know he's going to tackle the elephant in the room. So, Tim, racism isn't quite what I'd call mischievous. Right or wrong move for 10?
I think it probably is the right move. You've got 7 leading the market with Sunrise, now been going for about 7 or 8 years. You've got Today Show breathing down the neck of Sunrise, very well established on 9. With a presenter lineup which really seems to be firing, there isn't much of a chink in the armour. 10 obviously has taken the view, hey, why share all of that valuable advertising revenue? Why not share that valuable advertising revenue? But it's going to be very, very hard to break in. And they've obviously decided the way to quickly get cut through is to go for something which is probably going to be at times controversial. Yeah. Even if they have to fire him after 6 months, then it may have done the job.
But he's... seems to me clearly a racist. You're putting someone like that in front of, you know, 200,000 people every morning.
The segment we listened to was not the most flattering for him, was it? If you know, having mainly had his TV career in New Zealand, I've not seen much of him. But if I were to base my views on that clip, I would decide that he was a nasty little racist.
Yeah, do you think that's part of perhaps David Mott or 10's programming thinking? Thinks that there are quite a lot of Australians that perhaps think along the same lines that he does.
I don't know. I mean, let's remember that 10 have got quite a diverse lineup. You know, you've got a pretty kind of laid-back liberal with a small L attitude on things like The Project. Yeah. But then, of course, 10 is also the network which gives Andrew Bolt a show on a Sunday morning, you know, a politics show. So a diversity of voices coming from that network, that's for sure. Yeah.
So, Rich, good news for a struggling brand, 10, you think?
I think they've obviously taken the decision that they can't just pussyfoot around this. They need to, you know, go after someone who's going to, you know, maybe cause some controversy. You know, not that I'd ever, you know, support or advocate for what just happened in that clip. But I think to Tim's point, they've got a real diverse lineup there, and they're trying by hook or by crook to, you know, ramp up the numbers.
Now, elsewhere in TV, Ten's hour-long version of The Project had a pretty good first week. Some analysis by Ten, which they passed on to us at Mumbrella, suggests that The Project has actually grown Ten's audience in that new extended time slot overall compared to George Negus, which was in it before, with a jump up from about 11.9% share to 17.9% share in its commercial TV ratings for 16 to 39-year-olds, which is one of the key advertising demographics. Still third behind Current Affair and Today Tonight, but closing the gap. Today Tonight, about 24% share. Current Affair with a 19.1% share, and The Project with a 17.9% share in that demographic. So getting much closer. But I also noticed that this week, falling back a bit, only doing about 500,000 or not much more on some nights. Were you sorry when George Negus got the bullet?
To be perfectly honest, I'm not a massive TV watcher.
What are your TV habits? What have you been watching recently?
Well, the thing that's caught my attention recently is Killing Time, which is on TV1 of all places, which I find a little bizarre, kind of in between the reruns of The Office and whatever else. But it's a great drama series starring David Wenham. And, I'm really, really getting into that.
So it's a kind of mob lawyer in the 70s or the 80s?
In the 80s. And it's, look, great, great writing, great acting. So I've been getting into that. But, you know, what with this world of getting media from all sorts of different places, you know, the days of sitting down in front of the telly are long gone, and if anything, when I do sit down in front of the telly, it's usually to end up watching The Wiggles.
Have you had time to watch any Celebrity Apprentice yet, speaking of children's entertainers?
I have. Between myself and the missus, The Apprentice gets a bit of a go. But I'd have to say, I think the calibre of celebrities that you get on the US version is a little bit different to, shall we say, what we get in Australia.
Although Jason Coleman does cry nearly as much as Meatloaf.
Yes, there is that. And look, it's a real motley crew. But I think I've watched as many episodes of Celebrity Apprentice as I can. So I might have to leave it for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, you're running out of time. Next week is the final week, actually. We're into the final week already. So they're certainly not outstaying the welcome, but that's one of the things about a strip show, I suppose. You know, so what were you, Robin, have you been surprised by the success of Celebrity Apprentice?
Yes, I have. To be honest, I watched the show last night and wasn't...
No, you don't have to sound apologetic about that.
Yeah, no. It's the first time I watched it. It's engaging for about 20 minutes before I switched. I just channeled. The actual TV story that I wanted to ask you about this week was today, the Nine Breakfast Show that aired in Brisbane, you may remember.
Yes.
A repeat of the Michael Jackson trial results. And what amazed me, they aired the segment, then they aired it again, and the ratings actually increased.
What happens across Australia is things like Sunrise and The Morning Show on 7 and Today on 9 will air live in the East Coast, so Sydney, Melbourne, for instance, and then on an hour's delay, which kind of, you know, in Brisbane, for instance, because of, you know, what the time difference is at the moment, and then on a delay again in Perth. Now, clearly that makes sense most of the time because, you know, you're pacing your show for the time people are getting up and going out. But what happened was that the result came in for the Michael Jackson manslaughter case. So the verdict came in at about 8 a.m. Sydney, Melbourne time. So in Brisbane, both networks cut live. So if you were in Brisbane, you're up till 7 o'clock, you're watching it on an hour's delay, suddenly, bing, you're live, you're watching the same thing you're watching in Sydney and Melbourne, which is great until you get to 8 o'clock Brisbane time, 9 o'clock Sydney, Melbourne time, and the shows are due to finish. So what Sunrise did was they went for another hour.
So there was still today?
This is what Sunrise did on 7.
Oh, right, okay.
They stayed live, which meant that there was still something to go into Brisbane to fill that gap between 8 and 9. Today didn't. Today stopped at 9 o'clock Sydney time, which meant that the network in Brisbane didn't have anything to show, so they just replayed the hour. So they went back from Andy's guilty and here's the reaction to suddenly we're waiting for the reaction again, and got to see him being found guilty all over again. So a somewhat bizarre scenario, which happens from time to time because of those quirks of time differences and stuff, yeah. But that one did seem particularly acute. Yeah.
So when they cut live in Brisbane, did the ratings go up?
The ratings were actually 6,000 but greater than they were the day before.
So it was worthwhile playing it twice?
Well, what we don't know is whether they would have been up anyway, but I suppose arguably, because people tend to, particularly the habits for breakfast tends to be that they will actually dip in for 10 or 15 minutes, the chances are that a great deal of people are watching it between 8 and 9 a.m. Brisbane time didn't realise they were watching something on an hour delay. So yeah, they kind of, they got away with it. And that is all we have time for today. Thank you very much to Richard.
Absolute pleasure.
To Robin.
Cheers, Tim.
And to Colin.
Thank you.
The Mumbrella Cast was recorded in the studios of Mumbrella House. See you next week. Toodle-pip.